Hello and welcome to another episode of Macabre Mortals. Thank you so much for joining me back in this series of unsolved murders. This week I will be covering three unsolved cases that were in the decade of the 1940s. I thought this was a good way to sort of briefly touch on a few cases that don't really have too much information, except the last one does. And the last one has to be one of my, I hate saying favourite cases, because I think it's a bit morbid and a bit macabre to say that, but it is Macabre for Mortals. So it's one of the cases that fascinates me the most. And it actually links to a book that I read and what sort of sparked my interest in the case. So today we are going to be covering the Happy Valley murder, or scandal in the Shangri-La. Also going to be covering the case of who put Bella in the witch elm, and also the case of the Black Dahlia. While most Britons were suffering the perils and privations of World War II, far away in Africa, a few wealthy aristocrats were living the high life until murder shattered their exotic ideal. The murder of Jocelyn Hay, the 22nd Earl of Errol, Baron of Kilmarnock, and High Constable of Scotland, scandalised wartime Britain by exposing the decadent habits of a group of wealthy expatriates in colonial Kenya. Speculation was also rife as to the murderer's possible motive. Was it a crime of passion prompted by Hay's notorious womanising? Or could his death have been a political assassination provoked by his fascist connections? Hay was a part of a small group of privileged white Britons sitting out the war by living a life of hedonism and luxury in Kenya. The group was known as the Happy Valley Set, and the White Highlands of Kenya was their playground. The Happy Valley Set became infamous for their debauched lifestyles, their sexual promiscuity, excessive drinking and drug use, and continuous partying shocked the small community of settlers who were striving to create farmland from the African bush. Hay first arrived in Kenya in 1924 with his wife, Lady Edna Sackville, with whom he had eloped with while she was still married to her first husband. Hay barely pretended to be faithful, but Dina reportedly did not mind the numerous love affairs her husband was having behind her back. Edina was only happy if all her guests had swapped partners, wives or husbands by nightfall, wrote James Fox in his celebrated book, The Happy Valley Case, White Mischief. In fact, the couple's dinner parties at their ranch house, Clouds, were the talk of the area. A regular event at these gaudy soirees was a sheet game in which nude men lined up behind a sheet and the female guests then attempted to identify them by just the lower regions. In 1928, the couple divorced amidst rows over financial issues, and Hay moved in with Edith Moord, Molly Ramsey Hill, a married woman some years Hay senior. When Ramsey Hill's husband was made privy to the affair, he confronted the couple and chased Hay with a rhino whip. Molly was soon divorced, and she and Hay wed in 1930. After leaving her husband, Molly bankrolled both her and her younger husband. They lived in Osirian, a flashy Moroccan-style home on the shores of Lake Navista in Kenya, and Hay's chiselled looks, arrogant air and quick wit made him irresistibly attractive to clique of broad and upper-class settlers' wives. A serial philanderer and gambler, his speciality was seducing rich married women. Meanwhile, Molly Ramsey Hill was so immersed in herself and the alcohol and drug-fueled Happy Valley lifestyle that she died of overindulgence in 1939. The following year, Hay encountered Lady Diana Delves Broughton, a voluptuous 26-year-old with deep blue eyes and wispy blonde locks. Many women in the Happy Valley set envied her beauty and instant sex appeal. Lady Diana had recently married the much older Sir Jock Delves Broughton, 11th Baronet DL, and largest landowner in Kenya. Recently divorced, Sir Jock decided to take his young wife to Kenya to escape his mountain depths, as well as to get away from wartime Britain. The attraction between the rakish aristocrat Hay and Lady Diana was instant. They soon embarked on a passionate and highly visible affair, which Sir Jock was said to be very nonchalant about. When he and Diana married, they had reportedly made a pact that they would set each other free should either one of them fall in love with someone else. Sir Jock later claimed that he took a philosophical view of his beautiful young wife's affair and with his friend and resolved to take a step back. As if to demonstrate that he bore the couple no ill will, on 23rd of January 1941, Sir Jock invited Lady Diana and Hay to a dinner party at the exclusive Muthuaga Club, a frequent haunt of the Happy Valley set, along with several other friends. During this lavish event, Sir Jock, though drinking heavily, played the perfect part of graceful loser. He even toasted the new couple with champagne and wished them every happiness. Within hours, Hay would be dead. As the dinner party reached its drunken conclusion, Hay and Lady Diana decided to continue celebrating and went out dancing. At around 2:15 a.m., Hay dropped off Lady Diana at the home she shared with Sir Jock and climbed back into his Buick to drive the short distance to his own house. Scarcely an hour later, two dairy workers discovered his body. His car's headlights were still blazing. Hay's body was in a kneeling position in the front passenger footwell. A bullet had entered his head just behind his right ear. Powder marks on the side of his face indicated that he had been shot at close range. In the car, police found a cigarette butt soaked in blood, in what remains the most arguably one of the most bungled police inspections in criminal history. Hay's body was removed before being carefully examined, and police trampled all over another set of tire tracks that could have been bearing on the case. Hay's Buick was given a thorough wash before a decision was made to dust for fingerprints. The murder of Jocelyn Hay, the 22nd Earl of Errol, marked open season on his reputation, and the stories of his hedonistic lifestyle flashed across British newspapers, along the news of the nightly raids by the German bombers. He quickly became a symbol of debauched aristocracy, and eager for distraction from the Blitz, the nation revelled in his downfall. Before long, his affair with Lady Diana became common knowledge, and Sir Jock was named the prime suspect in the murder. He was duly arrested on the 10th of March and charged with Hay's murder, but Sir Jock denied any involvement in the crime, citing the fact that he had invited Hay and Lady Diana to the dinner party the evening before the murder, as evidence that he was not jealous or angry about the breakdown of his marriage. During the subsequent trial, Lady Carberry, a close friend of the Broughtons, testified that despite his protestations, Sir Jock appeared unhappy during the dinner party. He told her that he planned to give his wife his estate or he'll make her an allowance. He also announced that he had been extraordinarily lonely during his short marriage. Lady Carberry added that after the death of Hay, on one occasion, she and Sir Jock had lunch, during which he broke down and wept. So far as the evidence against Sir Jock was little more than supposition, the prosecution claimed that the bloodstained cigarette butt found in Hay's car constituted as evidence that Sir Jock was a murderer, on the slender basis that Hay did not smoke. But Sir Jock was known to smoke two brands of cigarette. Searching for hard facts, the prosecution pinned its hopes on showing that the single bullet that killed Hay came from a 32 Colt found in Sir Jock's home. When the ballistics expert testified that the bullet that killed Hay could not have come from a Colt, any Colt, the absence of a murder weapon destroyed the prosecution's case. After just 3 hours of deliberation, Sir Jock was acquitted. A contributing factor to this verdict may have been the fact that the foreman of the jury was Sir Jock's barber. Far from being welcomed back after this ordeal, Sir Jock was shunned by his former Happy Valley friends. Lady Diana, apparently recovering quickly from the shock of Hay's murder, immediately left Sir Jock for Gilbert Coverley, a millionaire cattle rancher who lived nearby. Nursing a back injury, Sir Jock returned home to England alone and stayed in the Adelphi Hotel in Liverpool. On the 5th of December 1942, Sir Jock Delves Broughton committed suicide with a morphine overdose. To many observers, Sir Jock's suicide was tantamount to admission of guilt. And a month after Sir Jock's death, Lady Diana married an eminently respectable Gilbert Colvey. In her 2003 book, Elizabeth Huxley, a biography, C.S. Nichols, an authority on colonial Kenya, named Sir Jock as the murderer. By her account, Sir Jock lay in waiting for Hay as he drove Lady Diana home. He got into Hay's car, shot him, and then drove to the crossroads for a large sum of money. So Jock had arranged for an acquaintance, Dr. Alphen Phillip, to meet him there and drive him back to his house. The theory that Hay may have been killed by a jealous husband was one thing, but when Sir Jock was acquitted, speculation arose that it could have been a political motive for the murder. Could Hay have been assassinated by a British agent because he was a fascist sympathiser, suspected of collaborating with the Germans? Hay had actually joined the British Union of Fascists for a year in 1934. There was even rumours that he was involved in a renegade group that included the Duke of Windsor and Rudolf Hess. An investigation by the Sunday Times speculated that Hay had abused his position as second in command of the Kenyan armed forces by selling secrets to Mussolini's forces in Italia, East Africa. It was well known that British military plans had been leaked to the Italian army headquarters in Addis Ababa. Could Hay have been responsible? Giving more weight to the theory, several close associates of Lady Diana alleged that Hay was lined up to be the governor of Kenya in the event of a successful Italian invasion. Other commenters have suggested the possibility that a scorned lover did the deed. There are even some who believe that Hay was killed by Lady Diana when he refused to marry her. However, as their passionate romance was still in its first flush, and she was apparently at home in bed at the time of his death, this was thought unlikely. In 2010, a fresh suspect was brought to light when Paul Spicer began researching the American heiress Countess Alice de Jeune, who had been a close friend of his mother and a leading member of the Happy Valley set. In his book, The Temptress, The Scandalous Life of Alice, Spicer related that Alice had an on-and-off relationship with Hay over the course of several years. Coincidentally, she had experience with a gun, having shot her lover, the English nobleman and playboy Raymond de Trufford, and then herself at a Paris railway station in 1927. Both fortunately survived, and Alice was dubbed the fastest gun in the Gare du Nord. Alice said he received a 6-month suspended sentence for the shooting of Raymond and herself. The French court viewed the crime leniently as a crime of passion. And Spicer claimed that Alice had an issue with rejection and suggested that, incensed by Hay's budding relationship with the much younger Lady Diana, she could have arranged to meet Hay at the crossroads and shot him. She had the motive and she certainly had the nerve. She would not fear carrying out the act. She was consumed with jealousy. Soon after the murder, Alice visited the mortuary where Hay's body lay and kissed him on the lips, reportedly exclaiming, "Now you are mine forever." Alice had dabbled in the occult, and many have hoped to have reunited with her former lover in some form of afterlife. In any event, she never got over his death and committed suicide in September 1941. Spicer claimed that she left a note for the police in which she confessed to the murder. However, the contents of this letter have never been revealed. The glare of publicity surrounding the murder of Hay marked the beginning of the end for Kenya's colonial expat elite. But the question of who pulled the fateful trigger that dark night and why continues to cast its lurid, groundless spell. Who put Bella in the witch elm? 1943. Was she a German spy, the victim of a black magic ritual, or an unfortunate vagrant. Who Bella really was is just one of this murder's mysteries, unanswerable riddles. More than 75 years have passed since a woman's skeleton was found stuffed inside a wiltshelm in a park in Worcestershire during World War II. Following this grim discovery, cryptic graffiti asking the question, "Who put Bella in the wiltshelm?" started to appear around the district. Bizarre theories of German spies and witchcraft rituals keep this local legend alive, and the strange and sinister tale of Bella still captivates armchair detectives today. Despite a lengthy police investigation and a plethora of plausible and not so plausible theories, the identities of the woman nicknamed Bella and that of her killer remain a mystery. The story of the case begins in a fittingly dramatic fashion. As dusk was falling on the 18th of April 1943, four teenage boys were curiously trudging through Hagley Woods. This stretch of woodland was situated on the grounds of the impressive Hagley Hall estate, which belongs to Lord Cobham. The four boys, Bob Hart, Tom Willits, Fred Payne, and Bob Farmer, were trespassing. Braving the dangers of getting caught by the angry gamekeeper, they were looking for some excitement to take their minds off the nightly German Luftwaffe bombing raids, which were wreaking havoc in Birmingham, their hometown. They had their dogs with them and were hoping to supplement their family's meagre meat ration with a poached rabbit or two. After a while, Bob Farmer spotted the wiltshelm, named for its strange appearance, and decided to climb it, hoping to find a bird's nest. He clambered up and peeked down into the hollow trunk. A glimmer of white convinced him that he had hit the jackpot. However, the object lodged in the middle of the tree was not a bird's nest. Bob pulled it out and found himself staring at a skull, whose empty eye sockets seemed to stare right back at him. At first, he thought that the skull was that of an animal, until he noticed clumps of what looked like human hair clinging to it and crooked teeth protruding from its mouth. The boys fled the woods, promising each other never to tell a soul about what they had found for fear of getting into trouble. Despite the promise they had made, the seriousness of their find weighed heavily on 17-year-old Tom Willits. Shortly after he had returned home, he told his parents about what he and his friends had found in Hagley Woods, and they alerted police. The area was soon cordoned off. Inside the ominous-looking tree, they found a woman's skeleton. Disturbingly, her hand was missing, the bones discovered scattered around the tree. A cheap imitation gold ring and size 5.5 crepe-soled shoes were also found a short distance away. Scraps of poor quality clothing hung from the bones, and a piece of taffeta fabric was stuffed inside the mouth of the skull, indicating that the victim had been suffocated. The medical examiner, Professor James Webster, concluded that the woman was around 35 years old, had irregular teeth in her upper jaw and light brown hair, and was just about 1.52 meters or 5 foot tall. He also determined that the woman had given birth to one child in her lifetime and estimated that she had been dead for about 18 months. Professor Webster's findings made him certain that the death of this unknown woman was murder, stating, "I cannot imagine a woman accidentally slipping in there. Neither do I think it's reasonable for a woman to crawl into that place to commit suicide." He also concluded that the woman had been placed inside the hollow trunk before rigor mortis, the stiffening of the muscles following death, had set in. Otherwise, the body would have been too stiff to fit inside the narrow tree trunk. Professor Webster also maintained that the victim would most likely have been killed close to the spot where she was found. Otherwise, the killer would not have been able to transport her body to the tree before rigor mortis would be set in. It was an excellent place for the concealment of a murderer, And I think it indicates local knowledge. Following the discovery in the witch elm, Worcestershire police contacted every dentist in the area, hoping that one of them would recognise the woman's distinctive protruding teeth. They also trawled through 3,000 missing persons reports to see if any of them matched to the description of the deceased. Neither line of inquiry turned up any leads, and the investigation then turned towards the personal effects found at the scene. The crepe-soled shoes were traced to a Waterford company in Lancashire, and investigators were able to find the owners of all but six pairs, which had been sold from a market stall in Dudley, a town roughly 18 kilometres or 11 miles from Birmingham. The complexity of the investigation caused the trail to become colder with each passing week. The numerous tragedies of war soon distracted the public and police attention from the tree murder riddle, and the woman remained unidentified, and the case was quietly forgotten. Then, about 6 months later, mysterious graffiti began to appear in the area. In Christmas 1943, the first graffiti message appeared. The first message, written in chalk on the side of a house nearby the old hill, read, "Who put Lubella down the witch elm?" This was the first time that the name had been connected to this deceased woman. Over ensuing months, similar messages appeared, written all by the same hand. Gradually, they took on the same word for "Who put Bella in the witch elm?" The graffiti rang with the implication that somebody knew who killed Bella, but appeals by police to find the artist all proved unsuccessful. In the late 1940s, the new messages started to appear asking the same question. Was this a clue or a taunt? The case became a whodunit that gripped the nation. The combination of mysterious messages and the lack of an identity for the victim prompted some fanciful theories. One notion that surfaced early on in the investigation was that Bella could have been the victim of a black magic ritual. According to anthropologist Professor Margaret Murray, the fact that Bella's hand was severed from her arm and the bones scattered bore similarities to an occult ceremony known as the Hand of Glory. She also concluded that the murder was somehow connected to another case potentially involving witchcraft, the murder of Charles Walton, who was stabbed and pinned to the ground by his own pitchfork in the nearby village of Lower Quinton. Developing the theory that witchcraft was involved, it was noted that the plant belladonna, also known as deadly nightshade, and witch hazel are both associated with the occult, and according to local legend, so is Hagley Woods. The fact that Bella was entombed inside a tree rather being buried is also indicative of ritualistic slaying, according to Professor Murray. The theory that Bella was executed for some crime against the coven quickly gathered steam and remains the favorite theory even today. Investigators working on the case, however, dismissed the theory, declaring the bones from Bella's hand simply to be scattered by animal predation. During World War II, several German spies were captured in the UK. As a result, in 1953, the case of Bella and the Witch Elm attracted a new line of inquiry, war espionage. The Wolverhampton Express and Star received a letter from somebody who identified herself only as Anna of Calvary. She claimed to have information on the identity of Bella and was interviewed by the journalist Wilfred Barrow Jones. According to Anna, Bella was a member of Aspiring, seeking information about the location of local munitions factories that could be targeted by the Luftwaffe. Anna was then identified as Una Mossop, and she alleged that her RAF pilot husband, Jack Mossop, had witnessed Bella's death. She said that Mossop had told her that he had become involved in Aspiring along with a Dutchman called Van Ralt. One evening, Van Ralt, accompanied by a woman Mossop believed to be Bella, had picked up Mossop in his car. Shortly after, Van Ralt strangled a woman, allegedly because of her spy associations. Another version of this story claims that Jack Mossop and Van Ralt had been drinking with Bella in a local pub when she became drunk and passed out. The two men then placed the woman in a tree to teach her a lesson, and when she awoke, she was unable to climb out and perished. However, this theory doesn't explain the discovery of the taffeta stuffed inside her mouth. Whichever version was reported to the newspaper has become obscured by time. But what is known, that is, Jack Mossop died in St. George's Hospital, Stafford, before Bella's body was discovered. Allegedly, recurring nightmares of Bella's skull stuffed inside the tree ultimately led to her mental breakdown. Von Rott was never found, and investigators considered Mossop's testimony to be nothing more than hearsay from an estranged wife, told 12 years after the discovery of Bella. In later years, declassified MI5 files gave some weight to this spy theory. The files revealed information concerning a German spy named Joseph Jacobs, who was captured after breaking his ankle while parachuting into Cambridgeshire in 1941. After Jacobs' arrest, a creased photograph of the glamorous German actress and cabaret singer Clara Buell was found in his pocket. Jacobs told his interrogators that Buell was his lover and that the Third Reich has recruited her as a spy. According to Jacobs, Buell had parachuted into the West Midlands in 1941 and disappeared. Could Burrell have been the woman Una Mossop had mentioned? Josef Jacobs was never able to shed any more light into Burrell's fate, as he was executed by firing squad in August 1941. However, it's certain that Clara Burrell could not have been Bella, for the simple reason that Burrell was tall, around 1.78 meters, or 5 foot 10 inches, where Bella was only 5.1 meters, or 5 foot in height. Finally, in 2016, it was discovered that Clara Burrell had died in a Berlin hospital in December 1942. Alongside all of these imaginative theories, there was speculation that Bella may have been someone with a transient lifestyle, a person not easily traced in life and thus not particularly missed in death. In August 2014, BBC Radio 4 broadcast a program that suggested that Bella was a prostitute who had worked the streets around Hagley Road. According to police files, Bella had disappeared in 1941, which would fit the timelines of events. Locals pointed out that the fact that travellers, which they called gypsies, had camped out in the vicinity of Hagley Woods during 1941. Perhaps Bella was one of them and had been killed by a member of her own community. But yet another suggestion was that Bella was a local barmaid who had been killed by an American GI. With no concrete evidence to support them, these various theories have ultimately led nowhere. One straightforward and perhaps most probable hypothesis is Bella was a homeless woman with no loved ones to report her missing. Quite simply, she may have been a woman who just fell through the cracks. In 2018, a team from Liverpool John Moores University used photographs of Bella's skull to create a digital impression of how she may have looked while she was alive. As the decades passed, the mystery continued to grow. The sinister-looking tree, the severed hand, and the whispers of witchcraft and espionage have combined to weave this tragic tale of an anonymous woman's murder into a darkly fascinating legend. Our last and final case is the case of the Black Dahlia in 1947. I actually read a book called The Red Dahlia, and it is set in modern day times, and it harkens and makes lots of links to the case of the Black Dahlia. It is an absolutely amazing book, and if you can get hold of it or you can listen to it, I know it's on Audible. I have listened to it since reading it myself. It's really good. It's just one of those books where the author really understands criminal cases and criminal investigations and everything that happens to it. Another key thing is the author actually has severe dyslexia, and to see the amazing things that she has been able to do and overcome that disability. Fabulous. She longed to become an actress, a Hollywood star. However, a very different sort of fame lay in store for the pretty raven-haired girl, universally remembered in the history of crime as the Black Dahlia. The morning of the 15th of January 1947 was dreary and chilly when a Los Angeles housewife, Betty Bersinger, set off for a shoe repair shop with her 3-year-old daughter, Anne. On South Norton Avenue, they passed an eerie abandoned lot overgrown with bush and weeds. Something white caught Betty's eye. At first, she thought it was a broken and tossed aside mannequin, discarded perhaps because it was broken in half. Side note, it never is a mannequin. Then she realized the two halves were that of a body of a woman. I was terribly shocked and scared to death, Betty later told a reporter. She grabbed her daughter and rushed to the first house that had a phone. The woman that Betty and her daughter had discovered would quickly become a household name, as newspapers across the country detailed every twist and turn in the search for her elusive killer. Her name was Elizabeth Short, a young woman who had gone to California hoping for stardom, only to achieve it after her gruesome death. It was those two elements, the glamorous Hollywood dreams and the lurid details of Elizabeth's murder, that catapulted the case into the public's consciousness, like few others before it. The young woman had been sliced carefully in half, drained of her blood, and then posed in a bizarre spread eagle display amongst the weeds. Rope marks scarred her ankles, wrists, and throat, and police believed that she had been hung upside down by her feet and tortured for hours before her death. Her mouth had also been slashed into a grotesque, too wide smile. As the Los Angeles Times reported, the victim of one of the city's most brutal killings, according to veteran detectives, the attractive brunette could have died from head wounds, a deep stab wound in the abdomen, frenzied slashings from the back, or from strangulation. Jagged knife wounds were also found on the breasts and the left leg, running from the mouth across the face. Those who knew her could not imagine how this became the fate of the girl they affectionately called Beth or Bet. Elizabeth Short was born in Hyde Park, Massachusetts, in July 1924, to Phoebe May Sawyer and Cleo Short. Even as a child, she stood out with her raven hair and grey-green eyes. Her small nose was slightly upturned. The only physical flaws noted in death were a few surgical scars, chewed fingernails, and bad lower teeth. She always wanted to be an actress, said Phoebe the week after Elizabeth's death. She was ambitious and beautiful and full of life, but she had her moments of despondency. Sometimes she would be gay and carefree, and then in the depths of despair. Such swings are not usual for some young women. Elizabeth's early home life was troubled. Her father lost most of his life savings in the 1929 market crash and abandoned his family the following year. Phoebe was left to raise her five daughters alone. The fatherless family moved from Medford to Medford, Massachusetts, where Phoebe worked as a bookkeeper. Elizabeth struggled with asthma and recurring bronchitis, and the suggestion to move to a more hospitable climate led to her happily dropping out of high school in 1943 and head to California to pursue her acting dreams. She stayed for a few months with her father in Vallejo, California, but the reunion was not happy. He claimed that she would not stay home, so I told her to go away, and I go mine. And he never spoke to her again. When Elizabeth's father learned of her murder, he told police, "I want nothing to do with this." By 1947, 22-year-old Elizabeth had made something of a home in San Diego. She appeared occasionally as a movie extra and auditioned for acting jobs whenever she could. She loved to see and be seen in the movie colony spot, said one friend. Her roommates and friends told police that she had several suitors. The media frenzy that engulfed Elizabeth's death cannot be understated. Her face was featured time and time again on the front pages of newspapers across the country. The case took a life of its own, said Los Angeles Police Detective Brian Carr, who was overseeing the case between 2000 and 2009. Reporters soon began calling Elizabeth the Black Dahlia, a sensational monkey bestowed in part as a nod to the then movie The Blue Dahlia, and because of her dark hair and her fondness for black clothing. It was a front page news in all the local newspapers every day. Every development in the case, no matter how fruitless, seemed to have warranted breathless coverage. When Elizabeth's friend said she had bragged about being friends with famous actress Anna Todd, the wire service United Press International announced that police would question the British star. Todd told police that she'd never met the slain starlet. One suspect after another was arrested, each getting the guilty man's treatment for a day. Police interviewed more than 150 suspects. 25-year-old Robert Red Manley, a married sailorman, had been dating Elizabeth and, according to her roommates, had threatened her. He had driven her from San Diego to Los Angeles a week before her death. Robert Manley is the last person to see Elizabeth Short alive. Newspapers nationwide ran the photo of Manley taking a polygraph lie detector test. 29-year-old Army Corporal Joseph Dumas was also said to have been dating Elizabeth shortly before her death. Interest in him was piqued because he said that he blacked out after their date and had no memory about what had happened to her. Both leads fell apart when each man provided alibis that checked out. Having drawn a blank so far, police shifted focus to the women in Elizabeth's life. Could the killer have been a girlfriend or a wife of one of Elizabeth's lovers? Indeed, Elizabeth's sex life was the undercurrent in many stories, with reporters and officials alike dwelling on the tawdry subject, a pattern passing judgment. The averages may have caught up with Bess Short. She may have picked up one man too many, was the observation of police psychiatrist Dr. Porter River. The killer then reached out to police, sending a letter created from words and letters cut out from various newspapers and magazines. The creepy correspondence read, "Here is Dahlia's belongings." Enclosed were Elizabeth's birth certificate, her address book, and other personal papers. A few days later, more of her belongings, a shoe and a bag, were found in a rubbish dump. The killer sent a letter to the examiner telling police where he would turn himself in. However, he never showed up. He sent another letter saying, "Have changed my mind. You would not give me a square deal. Dahlia killing was justified." Strangely, several innocent people, both men and women, did turn themselves in. And by 1996, police had fielded about 500 such confessions. In 1949, a bellhop named Leslie Dillon contacted Dr. DeRiver, saying he wanted to discuss the murder for a book he hoped to write. DeRiver immediately grew suspicious, as Dillon had previously worked as a mortician's assistant, meaning he knew how to drain blood from a body, as had been done with Elizabeth's corpse. And without prompting, Dillon revealed details of the crime which police had never been able to explain. After questioning Dillon implicated his friend, Jeff Connors, who police interviewed but released. Investigators refocused on Dillon, and he was set to appear in the late 1949 before a grand jury. However, the case was dismissed when a judge ruled that Dillon had been illegally detained. In 2017, author Pierre Utwell presented the theory that Dillon had orchestrated the Black Dahlia murder with his friend Connors and Mark Hansen, a local nightclub and cinema owner. Hansen was known to be a frequent bed to frequently bed chorus girls and wannabe actresses, despite being married. He was linked to Elizabeth because he had given her a place to stay months before her death, and in an address book, of Elizabeth, Mark Hanson's name was found in amongst her possessions. It was suggested that Hanson had connections within the police department, connections that had enabled the trio to get away with murder. More than 70 years after the crime, investigators continue to wade through the countless theories, and most can be discounted. But one of the most intriguing comes from a former homicide detective who claims to have figured out the killer's identity, his own father. Los Angeles Police Department veteran Steve Hodel began suspecting his father, a respectable Los Angeles doctor, after his stepmother gave him a small photo album that belonged to the elder Hodel after his death in 1999. The book, which measures just 3 inches square, contained black and white photographs, many of which Steve Hodel recognized. He then came upon 2 images of a black-haired woman he did not know. After painstakingly comparing facial contours and counting freckles, Steve Hodel became convinced that the photos were of the notorious Black Dahlia. "I loved my father and respected him," Steve Hodel told Associated Press reporter in 2003. "His blood flows through my body. He gave me being. But now I have come to look at my father as the true Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde." Hodel laid out his suspicions in his best-selling book, Black Dahlia Avenger: A Genius for Murder. According to the case files released 50 years after the slaying, Dr. George Hodel was indeed a suspect in Elizabeth's murder. Police electronically surveilled his homes for 3 weeks in 1950. Soon after, the Black Dahlia case was mentioned in court when Hodel was tried for committing incest with his daughter. He was acquitted of the charge. Transcripts of overheard conversations included Hodel saying, "Supposing I did kill the Black Dahlia, they couldn't prove it now. They can't talk to my secretary anymore because she's dead." At another point, Hodel also suggested that he might have killed his secretary. Why police didn't pursue Hodel is unclear. Officials have repeatedly declined the comment because the Black Dahlia investigation, while ice cold, is still technically open. "I don't have the time to prove or disprove Hodel's investigation," said LAPD Detective Brian Carr in 2006 episode of the television series called Case Files. "I'm too busy working on active cases." Hodel was not the first to accuse his own father of being the infamous killer. In 1995, a woman named Janice Knowlton released a book called Daddy Was the Black Dahlia Killer. She said that her deceased father, George, not only killed Elizabeth, but that she had witnessed the murder of it as a 10-year-old child. She claimed that she had been brought to Elizabeth's house during her father's affair with the Ravenhead starlet, and that police documents indicating that they sought a man named George as a suspect further implicated her father. Another doctor was put forward as a possible suspect. Larry Harnish, a Los Angeles Times copy editor, suggested that the man named Walter Bailey could have been the killer. Bailey was a surgeon until he left his wife some 4 months before the murder, had lived one block from the lot in which Elizabeth's body was dumped. Harnish became convinced Bailey was a viable suspect after learning that one of the doctor's daughters was good friends with Elizabeth's sister, Virginia. According to Harnish, Bailey left his wife for another woman, a fellow doctor named Alexandra von Pontycke. Alexandra allegedly ended up blackmailing the doctor because he knew a secret about him, possibly that he was a Black Dahlia killer. According to one of the countless websites dedicated to tracking the case, at least 8 men are still labeled as people of interest in one fashion or another. They include Los Angeles Times publisher Norma Chandler, who some allege had dated Elizabeth, a medical doctor named Patrick O'Reilly, who allegedly met Elizabeth through a nightclub, owner Mark Hanson, and who was once convicted of sexual assault of his secretary, an unidentified dark-haired man pictured with Elizabeth in an undated photo found in the trunk of her car. With today's advances in forensic science, it is feasible that the evidence in Elizabeth's case could have been tested to get solid new leads and find the killer once and for all. However, that is no longer possible. over the years physical evidence in one of the highest profile cases in California history has gone missing. Unless it is somehow recovered, the Black Dahlia mystery is destined to endure. Thank you for listening to another episode of Macabre for Mortals. Next time, I will obviously be covering some other unsolved cases in another decade. Soon, I am going to cover a few that do cross two decades, as there are some unsolved cases that I would like to dive a little bit more into in the future, and just to sort of round up this series a bit more. I prefer the cases that are older, as I feel like there isn't still living family members or anyone that I can really cause trauma to, and I just want to basically tell those stories. If you have any questions or you have any topics that you would like me to cover, then please send me an email at macabremortals@gmail.com. And wherever you are in the world, please stay safe.